This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. In the wake of Donald Trump's ascendancy to power, one mantra about defeating him has been organized at the local level. While that may sound abstract and even ineffective, there are cities in the U.S. where local organizing has borne fruit in powerful ways. One such city is Richmond, California, a town that for decades was at the whim of one of the biggest oil corporations in the world, Chevron. But a decade of grassroots organizing led to the political transformation of the city, making Richmond one of the most progressive and safest cities in the nation. How did it happen? Author Steve Early tells the story of Richmond in a new book called Refinery Town. The book's foreword is by Senator Bernie Sanders, who makes the case that to change U.S. politics, we need more cities like Richmond, California. Steve Early is a journalist, lawyer, labor organizer, and union representative. His writings have appeared in The Nation, The Boston Globe, The New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, and USA Today. And he's the author of several books, including Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. He now joins me to discuss Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's go back into history, particularly for those people who don't know much about Richmond, and you now live in Richmond, California. How is it that Chevron came to be the biggest political force in the city? How long has it been that way, and what are that company's ties to the city?
Well, the company known as Chevron today, a global energy giant, has been operating in Richmond or running a major oil refinery here for 110 years. For much of the last century, the company was known as Standard Oil, and it pretty much dominated the politics and economy of Richmond. It formed a pretty powerful establishment coalition with other forces, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Manufacturers Association. Richmond has always been a blue-collar industrial town. Its more recent allies have been developers who want to develop 32 miles of waterfront. And allied with them have been some elements of the labor movement, conservative building trades unions, police, and firefighters. That's the constellation of forces that progressives have been up against in the last 10 or 15 years, where they've been trying to make the city cleaner and greener and more equitable for all its 110,000 people.
So what impact has Chevron's presence and its dominance of the city, what impact did that have on Richmond's population?
Well, for many years, the toxic fallout of the refinery's operations have been a major concern of the Black and Latino low-income and working-class people who live downwind of the refinery. Chevron, like other major oil companies, is very much focused on production and profit. It is less concerned about workplace safety, which affects, of course, its own employees, and community health. So like many other refinery towns in California, Richmond residents have had problems with childhood asthma, cancer clusters, a whole variety of health problems related to people's proximity to a major oil refining facility.
And the refinery itself has had accidents, the latest one being in 2012?
Correct. In August of 2012, shortly after I moved to Richmond, there was what the U.S. Chemical Safety Board called a catastrophic pipe failure on the other side of the hill here. It led to a huge fire and towering plume of toxic smoke that spread over much of the East Bay. In the days following this accident, about 15,000 people were forced to seek medical attention of one sort or another in emergency rooms and clinics throughout the area. And the Chemical Safety Board and other investigative agencies quickly discovered that Chevron had for years been neglecting maintenance work on the failed pipe, and this was very much an avoidable incident.
And as you write in your book, that incident became a turning point in the city's history. But let's step back just a touch and talk. We've talked about Chevron. Let's talk about how people responded to Chevron, the same people impacted by the pollution, by the disdain for worker safety. How and when did they begin organizing? A major player in Richmond has been the Richmond Progressive Alliance.
Well, there was a group called the West County Toxics Coalition, a kind of pioneering environmental justice organization that did a lot of community education and agitational work in the 1980s, kind of a precursor to more recent environmental groups in Richmond. The Richmond Progressive Alliance got started about 15 years ago. And while environmental issues are a major focus of its electoral activity and community organizing, it has a broader program. It's a multiracial, multi-issue, working class-oriented group that runs candidates and also organizes around issues like housing affordability, police accountability, raising the minimum wage, and engaging in a broad range of issues that are directly affect the working class majority in the city.
So they then the Richmond Progressive Alliance, I mean, and you know, the transformation of the city did not take place overnight. There were years and years of activism that led to it. What was the political opposition they faced? How did Chevron ensure that its interests would dominate via supporting politicians on, say, the city council?
Well, Chevron is traditionally the biggest spender on local politics, and the dynamic of that, of course, has changed in the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. No longer is Chevron and other business interests restricted to maximum donations to individual candidates. The sky is the limit now. Their independent expenditures can total millions of dollars, and they have in the last three election cycles. Big oil, big soda, and last fall, real estate interests spent more than $7 million in Richmond politics, trying to elect unsuccessfully pro-business candidates and trying to defeat progressive critics of their activities.
So tell us about the election of 2014, November 2014. Chevron tried in vain to throw as much money as it could at local races. What happened? What was the political transformation that happened in November 2014?
Well, we had three progressive candidates up for election that year. One of them was our former mayor, Gail McLaughlin, who was termed out as mayor and who for 8 years prior to 2014 had made Richmond the largest city in the country with a green mayor. Chevron was definitely gunning for
her. And
what
do you mean by green mayor?
She was a Green Party member, and though she ran in our local nonpartisan races under the Richmond Progressive Alliance banner, she had been very active in green politics locally and statewide. Chevron did not want to see her return to the city council and spent more than $3 million in that single election cycle trying to elect its own slate and defeat the progressive candidates. They prevailed in that election, and last fall, two more progressives were elected in Richmond, and the Richmond Progressive Alliance now has a 5 out of 7 member supermajority on the city council. And last fall's candidates were greatly aided by a rent control measure that was adopted by a 2-to-1 majority when it was put before the voters on November 8th.
So 5 out of 7 seats on the city council. Now activists who are progressive, involved with the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Is it just the city council, or are there RPA activists throughout the sort of infrastructure of the city? Have they infiltrated the city to kind of retake control from Chevron?
Well, I wouldn't use that term. That's a little bit loaded. But,
sounds sinister, I know, but I mean it in a positive way.
Under Gail McLaughlin's leadership in City Hall, one of the things she did was encourage new forms of civic engagement by people who had primarily been grassroots activists in the past. And so lots of people got more involved in appointive positions on the Planning Commission, the Housing Commission, Parks and Recreation, now the new Rent Control Board. I'm a member of the City Personnel Board. That can be a step in the grievance procedure for city employees. I have a labor background, and that's an area of interest in mine. So people are finding new ways to put their energies and experience and skills to work for city government, not necessarily just as elected officials, but in these appointed volunteer capacities on various city boards and commissions, where they can work with city staff to help shape the direction of city policy as set by the mayor and the city council.
The 2012 fire at the Chevron refinery, was that one of the main reasons why the November 2014 election was a big loss for the company politically?
Well, the 2012 fire has had continuing ramifications for the city. The city sued Chevron, litigation that has yet to go to trial. California's Occupational Safety and Health Agency imposed a $1 million fine. The company's still appealing. Other county and state authorities went after the company for civil and criminal penalties that were settled. I think the major unfinished business is a 4.5 year effort by various state agencies, including OSHA, to strengthen refinery safety regulations. And we're hoping that new rules will be issued this year that will make both this refinery and others around the state safer, both for the workers employed by them and for the neighbors around them.
Let's talk about the cast of characters, some of the figures that you profile in your book, because it's important for us to put names and faces to the change that happens, not just that of the mayor, but just ordinary people. Tell us about the founder of the Richmond Progressive Coalition, I believe, by the name of Andre Soto.
Well, Andre Soto was one of our first candidates for city council in 2004. He grew up in Richmond. He did a city and county employee. He and his sons had been beaten and arrested by Richmond police in 2002 at a Cinco de Mayo festival, which was also a turning point in relations already very bad at that time between the Richmond police and the city's growing Latino population. So after that incident, Andres devoted himself to the cause of police reform. He ran for city council, though he didn't succeed. He has continued to be active in city politics as an organizer for the Communities for a Better Environment, one of the leading lobbying and community organizing groups trying to hold Chevron accountable, keep the refinery operations cleaner, reduce the carbon emissions, and tackle this overwhelming problem of slowing the process of global warming.
Steve, let's talk about some of the other people who are, you know, very inspiring figures in the transformation of Richmond from company town to progressive city. Betty Reed Soskin is a 95-year-old park ranger. Tell us her story and how she is part of this incredible cast of grassroots activists that have taken their city back.
Well, Betty works, as you said, as a park ranger at Richmond's Rosie the Riveter Museum, which celebrates the work of women and African-American workers, all workers, actually, in building ships during World War II at the Kaiser Shipyard. Betty actually was a worker for one of the unions that represented Kaiser Shipyard workers. She is a wonderful living historian and has educated thousands of people now about the history and development of the African-American community in Richmond, the wartime struggles that helped shape Richmond politics in the post-war years, the development of the civil rights movement here, the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And she is a real inspiration to many people in the community.
And the police chief in Richmond has also been a very interesting person. I suppose he's not the police chief anymore, but Chris Magnus, I remember seeing photographs of him during the height of the Ferguson uprising, holding a sign alongside protesters, and his sign said hashtag Black Lives Matter. I believe he was the only police chief in the nation who took such a public stand. Tell us about Chris Magnus and the transformation of the issue of public safety in Richmond.
Well, Richmond had a terrible reputation for street crime, gang violence, gun and drug trafficking, very high homicide rate 10, 12 years ago when Chris took over as the police chief. And he was hired by progressives in city government to transform the department, which he largely succeeded in doing before leaving 2 years ago to become police chief in Tucson, Arizona. The incident that you mentioned in 2014 was a truly unusual gesture of solidarity between a police chief and a community. He participated in Black Lives Matter protest, a peaceful vigil. This was criticized by the police union here, but widely applauded by many members of the community and elected officials in city government at the time.
And I mean, what he did, how he ran his police department really made a big difference in safety. The homicide rate is extremely low now. I understand crime rates are in general are down. I mean, is this a model that that Chris Magnus could share with other cities in the country?
Very much so. Chris was, when he was police chief here, was added to two Justice Department task force investigating police misconduct and failings, and in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland. He has spoken widely about the lessons of Richmond's community policing experiment, and he also worked very closely with a city program called the Office of Neighborhood Safety, which does outreach to local gang members, encourages people to join peacemaking activities in neighborhoods that are still quite torn too often by terrible incidents of violence and gun crime. So Richmond has several models really for innovative public safety programs.
And often the power of the police in cities where you have great wealth inequality, where you have corporate dominance, the state police is often seen as enforcing the power of corporations. Did you see the transformation of Richmond's police department be very much part of the transformation of the city's own sort of grassroots taking back power from Chevron?
Yes, I think during the years when Chris was hiring new people, making the department more diverse, retraining and developing new leaders in the department, there was a very big change in the way the police related to protests and marches and rallies, of which Richmond has many. Having progressive elected officials participating in protest activity, of course, changes the relationship between the protesters and the police. But I think we had many examples of where protest activity in other cities might have led to an overly aggressive and counterproductive police response. Things went off without a hitch here.
Let's talk about a couple of other folks who are on the city council. We talked about Mayor Gail McLaughlin. What about her vice mayor, Jovanka Beckles? She's a really interesting person as well. And then you also profile Melvin Willis, a very remarkable young man, only 26 years old, who's also on the city council. I mean, these are really great inspirations for people looking to get involved in city politics in the country.
Well, both Jovanka and Melvin, who was just elected last fall, have been a part of the Progressive Alliance leadership. Jovanka is a child protection worker for Contra Costa County and has a very demanding day job, but has committed herself in her part-time role as a city councilor to taking up the cause of gay and lesbian and transsexual youth in the community. She's taken some heat for that, but she's an important role model. And Melvin, at 26 last November, became the youngest person ever elected city councilor in Richmond. And as a result of his work on behalf of rent control and other community organizing projects, he was the top vote getter in a field of nine. He defeated by 2,000 votes a 40-year Chevron-backed old guard African-American Democrat by the name of Nat Bates. And I think he was helped by the endorsement of Bernie Sanders. He was inspired by Bernie, and he has a great future in Richmond politics and someone who's very much connected to the grassroots.
So in general, the story of Richmond, this refinery town, what is the main takeaway from it? I mean, it's not like they've kicked Chevron out of the city, right? What is the relationship between Chevron and the city remain like today? I imagine it's complicated and not terribly straightforward, given that Chevron employs city residents.
Yeah, I mean, there's an historical intertwining of the city and the company. Chevron remains the largest employer in the city. It has a lot of philanthropic activity that benefits many nonprofits and churches and public schools.
Corporations do that to basically buy the goodwill of its people, right? Of the people that works with.
That's a strategy. And when progressives say, hey, how about giving back to the community by paying your fair share of taxes, either higher property taxes or utility tax, manufacturing tax? There's a lot of pushback. The company litigates any attempt to increase its tax burden and, of course, is fighting the litigation over the 2012 fire. And as we know from the now 15-year legal fight involving Ecuadorian peasants, whose rainforest communities were damaged by a Chevron predecessor in Ecuador, Chevron will drag lawsuits about its environmental misconduct out for decades to avoid reaching some sort of settlement with affected people, whether they're in Richmond or in South America.
Right, absolutely. The Ecuador story is a tragic one. And every time you think Chevron's going to have to pay, it finds a way to wriggle out of it. So it remains present in the city. What's to stop the refinery from having yet another accident that, in spite of all of the progressive control of political offices, you still have this refinery operating at a time when we really need to see the demise of the fossil fuel industry?
Well, 2 years ago, the steelworkers who represent refinery workers, some of them in Richmond at Chevron and other neighboring refineries, had a nationwide contract campaign and in some places a strike involving up to 30,000 workers. And this was the first time that the steelworkers in the oil industry had struck in 30 years, and they raised demands that were related not only to workplace conditions for their own members, but the impact of refinery operations on the surrounding communities. They wanted limits on contracting out that can often be unsafe. They wanted curbs on forced overtime. They wanted better staffing levels. And there was a real strong blue-green alliance, solidarity coalition that grew up around that contract struggle 2 years ago. And I think workers now, at least in this refinery, those who picketed with environmentalists during their contract fight realize that they are stronger in their dealings with Chevron when they have community organizations on their side.
Well, Steve, does this struggle that Richmond has and Richmond residents have taken on and won many victories, does it offer some path forward for many cities around the country, you know, while we continue to petition the federal government on the bizarre things that are taking place in Washington, D.C. With, what Matt Taibbi calls our clown in chief? Can cities actually make change locally in this manner? It's not going to do things, it's not going to necessarily impact who he nominates to the Supreme Court, but given enough time, you can actually, it seems, make some real serious lasting change in your own community.
Well, I think cities are emerging as a first line of defense in the Trump era. Richmond, for example, was a pioneering sanctuary city. That position has recently been reiterated by our current mayor and police chief. Communities like Richmond that have been engaging community policing efforts have managed to reestablish some degree of trust and confidence between the police and the community. That would be immediately undermined if local cops became a tool of the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented workers. So Richmond is refusing to participate, as San Francisco is and many other cities. And I think action by cities together to fend off the worst of the Trump administration is going to be a very important part of what we're doing here and people are doing in many other places.
Right. Well, that's a really great perspective on it. And a quick correction, Matt Taibbi calls our president not clown in chief, but the insane clown president. Steve, I wanted
I like Maureen Dowd's description of him as a 70-year-old, seven-year-old. So.
Oh, I like that one too. That's great. We'll have to start a list. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book. I know you're going on book tour. We'll post details of the various places you'll be speaking at around the country on our website later today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Steve Early is a journalist, lawyer, labor organizer, and union representative. His writing has appeared in The Nation, The Boston Globe, and many other publications. He's the author of several books, including Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. We've been talking to him about his latest book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. It's about Richmond, California. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUWithSonali.